Okay, so from Tomasz Chodakowski, we've got The Pristine Sofa.
Sofa, so good.
I'm thinking this sofa is a character in itself. And it's a sofa in the middle of the North Yorkshire moors that never gets dirty.
Okay. And it's in the middle of the moors.
Yeah.
Is it like a northern kitchen sink drama?
Kind of, yeah. It's Shea Meadows.
That type of, yeah.
Yeah, that kind of thing. But this sofa never gets dirty, even though it's out in the North Yorkshire moors.
Jodie Whittaker
never gets dirty.
Is walking in the North Yorkshire moors, right?
Yeah.
And comes across this sofa for the first sort of time. She's the first person to find it.
Hmm.
Or she's the person who finds it first in this film. And I think this is going to have something to do with, like, class. And
well, what
social
has to
class.
I figured it. Paddy Constantine is going to be standing there right as she arrives, and he's going to have that really sad, grizzled look on him where it looks like he's about to cry, but he's too morose and distraught.
Okay.
He's also wearing a suit but that says DFS on it.
Wait, so
He's
already
selling the sofa.
Oh, I think he's the person who's selling the sofa has to come later.
No.
He's
there from the beginning.
Have you seen Rubber?
No, but I know what it is.
So there are huge scenes in that. Definitely an art film, by the way. huge scenes in that where there are just bunches of people all sat out in the desert watching the film take place through binoculars and talking to each other about what's going to happen in the film. They are you. They are the audience.
Again, yeah, this is a very common art house tactic of we don't have enough film to really make it work as like an hour and a half. Let's have people react to what's going on from somewhere completely different.
Yeah, so I'm thinking that, like, I think the pristine sofa.
There's a pub and people going, I hear that Jodie Whittaker is going off and looking at the sofa.
I feel like the sofa.
She's going to look for the sofa.
Is a metaphor
she
for
is.
Something, right? And I can't quite figure out what it is.
The sofa is a metaphor for something.
Yeah.
It's an art film, Matt. No shit.
Yeah, but it's a metaphor for, like.
Is it going to be a scene where she just buys a sofa from DFS?
It's
a metaphor for breaking social class.
Let's just pitch the film and then we'll add the metaphor later.
Oh man, no.
That is a very common tactic.
I think
Buddy Constantine is there.
And she's like a secretary. But she likes working. She likes walking in the moors, and
the misty Yorkshire moors.
Yep. Yeah, and then she sits down next to Freema Agyeman, who is a business lady, and she's also out there on the moors, and they just have been walking past, and she Freema Agyeman like. Yeah, Freema Agyeman sits down next to Jodie Whittaker, right? They're both now sat down. They've both seen this thing, and it's like a bench in a park, right? Just like a level.
It's a pristine sofa.
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
And Freema Agyeman says
they will not stop crying.
Freema Agyeman says, "What you're gonna get? What are you doing with your dirty clothes here?" Jodie Whittaker is a gardener, I've decided, not a secretary.
Okay.
What are you doing with your dirty clothes here? You're going to get the sofa dirty. And Jodie Whittaker says, no, it's a pristine sofa.
And then she starts, like, crying.
Yeah.
As the film slowly fades to black and white,
and then the sofa says, "You know, I've been
this is so bad.
I've been here longer than either of you two.
I've been here for as long as anyone can remember."
And no one has ever no one has ever sat on me, though. They just look at how pristine I am and
you're
cry.
Just, why are you arguing? I'm always going to be here. Go and live your lives. You're the same. Humans, you're all the same. And then Free Magimon and Jenny Whisker cry. And run away off into the moors, hugging and embracing, and
<What? laughs>
and dancing with each other also.
Dancing, cool.
And then
I've got it. You know how in the Book of Genesis,
yeah,
in the Bible,
yeah,
I'm familiar. Yeah.
There's that tree that God said. Don't eat the fruit from.
Yeah.
And then
Adam there's said, also
you can't tell me what to do. You're not my real dad.
Yeah. There's also what the Bible forgot to mention was there was also in the Garden of Eden a living room with a sofa in it.
Yeah.
And God was like, "Don't sit on that sofa, Adam and Eve." And Adam was like, "Why?" And he goes,
"Look, just trust me on this one.
Trust me on this one. Don't eat the fruit. Don't sit on my sofa.
if you eat the fruit, you will learn of the knowledge of sin. But if you sit on the sofa, you will learn that you will find the devil of being too comfy.
Pure comfort.
It sounds like you're making this up as you go along. Why can't I sit on the sofa, mate?
Stop making me not do things.
In the meantime, God and Adam are having an argument, and then in the meantime, Eve's eating the apple, and then the whole thing goes to shit. Adam never gets a chance to sit on the sofa.
Oh. Oh, okay. And that was Adam's main stick for like.
Yeah.
I really wanted to sit on that
sofa. Like,
why
did you eat that fruit? I really wanted to sit on the sofa.
There were two options to us in this garden.
And Eve was like, "Yeah, but you got to learn that sitting on the sofa was a sin. This is what happens when you sit on the sofa."
Well, I have an image.
You transcend into a higher plane of existence.
I think Free
Magimon. You sit alongside God when you sit on the sofa.
Yes.
Played by Paddy Considine.
Yeah.
Who appears every now and then as the DFS attendant.
Well, yeah, he's a DFS, but like that's
in the
that's
middle
the
of the Yorkshire Moors.
When they get back, because they're like, "Oh my God, we had such an amazing transcendent experience on this sofa. We're going back." They've become fast friends now. Going back. We thought we were so different and hated each other, but now we're friends because we had this amazing experience on the sofa because we felt like we were sitting alongside God. And then they get back to the sofa and Paddy Considine's sat there in a DFS uniform saying, I don't know how Paddy Considine talks, but saying like, "Everything must go."
And then
"I'm sorry," he says, "you're going to have to get on down to hell for the DFS sale now that you've sat on the sofa."
And then everyone fades away.
I'm thinking before that happens, Paddy Considine doesn't turn up, but there is like a giant queue of people waiting to sit on the sofa.
Yeah.
And like they're charging people to sit on the sofa and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the cost is your soul. So everyone walks away crying.
Yeah.
And it was only those two that the sofa gave a transcendent experience to.
Mm.
They didn't sit on the sofa, but their souls did.
There's all the souls sit on the sofa and then immediately go to hell. And that's when Paddy Considine appears and then goes, "Everything must go," and he destroys the world.
But there's a single child with a tear in her eye who says, "I don't think I should sit on the sofa because it's too clean for me. And I am not without sin." And then she's the only one who survives.
Paddy Considine chooses her and a little boy as well to start anew.
A new Garden of Eden on the Yorkshire Moors.
A new Garden of Eden with a new sofa and a new fruit.
That'll do.
All right, C.S. Lewis, calm down.
Yeah, but that's all just part of it. We've made it. We put classism, we put racism, we put, I think, a little bit of...
Monica? In my life?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, the audience is currently half clapping, half booing.
Yeah. We're not sure which.
We're doing very well. We don't even have to talk to Netflix anymore. We're talking to Amazon Prime.
As long as we get like one clap per two boos, we're fine.
Yeah.
The clap to boo ratio is sound for this art film. It's what we expected. We're gonna graph up like the clap to boo ratio for this art film is not what we expected. Maybe we should put it in only independent cinemas and not in the mainstream.
That's what they would expect
in the mainstream cineplexes.
But that's what they would expect. I think we should only put it in the multiplexes.
I think that general audiences should be forced to watch this. Let's put it at the start of a Pixar movie.
Let's interrupt the Black Panther film with this film. And then bolt the doors.
That'll wake up the sheeple.
Get me Disney's head on the phone. Wake it up.
Hello, it's me, Disney. From the jar.
May I ask you something? Can we make plushies out of Paddy Considine on the sofa?
And you cannot
make McDonald's meals.
You cannot rebuild the sofa.
That'll be the hashtag line. I love it.
There are people in the Midwest that are picketing this film. Boycotting the cinemas to not like and protesting outside saying don't go see this film, it's blasphemous.
We don't even need to pay for advertising. Let's just record the news footage of this and have that on its own.
So we've got an award to give away before we move on to the final pitch. That's the Yes Very Clever Award, a award we give to people who've given us titles that are based on existing titles. So we couldn't do really much of it. To be honest, this one we can probably could have done quite a lot with, seeing as it's art house, so we can interpret it any way we want.
Do what we want.
Do what we want with it. But from Chad Heathcliff Bentley, we've been given Not Being Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, I think we could have done something with that.
We could have done a lot with that, I think, but...
I think it would be like the documentary about Man on the Moon. What's his name? Jim Carrey. Jim and Andy, the Netflix documentary. It'd be like that, apart from Daniel Day-Lewis spends... They follow Daniel Day-Lewis closely as Daniel Day-Lewis tries not to be Daniel Day-Lewis for a month.
I think one of my favourite bits on Clickhole was when they said Paul Thomas Anderson has allowed Daniel Day-Lewis a sneak peek at his next role. So who am I playing this time? You are playing yourself. Daniel Day-Lewis cries with happiness.
Daniel Day-Lewis has a breakdown. I can finally go back to my job.
Being Daniel Day-Lewis.
Daniel Day-Lewis.
No, Daniel Day-Lewis's job is not being Daniel Day-Lewis. That's what he gets paid for.
He was a postman until someone said, "Do you want to be in a film?
Do you want a job?" I'll tell you what. Hey, Daniel Day-Lewis, you want a job? What are you doing? It pays pretty well. Yeah, but what is it? It's not being Daniel Day-Lewis.
He was in quite a low place in his life at that time. He was like, I want to be anything but Daniel Day-Lewis.
But eventually, he was so good at it, everyone demanded he stop becoming Daniel Day-Lewis forever.
It's like a dark La La Land.
Daniel Day-Lewis Forever, the sequel to Daniel Day-Lewis Returns. The sequel to Daniel Day-Lewis. But also, it goes Daniel Day-Lewis, Daniel Day-Lewis Returns, Daniel Day-Lewis Forever, and Daniel Day-Lewis and Robin. That's how that goes. Those four films.
And where does not being Daniel Day-Lewis come in?
In between Daniel Day-Lewis and Robin and Daniel Day-Lewis Begins.
Okay.
What if one day we just told Daniel Day-Lewis that his next role was to be Batman and just forget to film it and just watch him solve crimes?
Oh, my God. Oh, wait. What if we told Daniel Day-Lewis he was Batman and only shot when he thought the cameras were off?
Now, I'm getting really into my role by beating up these hoodlums. You're not recording any of this footage, right? This is all very, like, down, dirty, gritty work, right?
This is all very method.
But to be fair, he would clean up the crime in Gotham for...
Oh, my God.
A month or so, like...
No more crime in L.A.
That's the Life's a Pitch cinematic universe, the superhero cinematic universe. We get a load of method actors, tell them they're superheroes, and then film it. Just watch what happens.
Basically invert the lights on the cameras so that they come up red when they're not shooting.
Yeah. Just watch them solve crimes.
But all we have to do is tell them, look, we know you're not interested in the hoity-toity blockbuster multiplex scene. We're going a bit more experimental with this. Can you actually punch some poor people for us?
it's just like, you know what? We want to encourage all of your particular methods. These are going to be very difficult characters to inhabit, and we feel... we spread the rumour among the cast that the reason that the Marvel Cinematic Universe took off and the DC one didn't was because they were everyone on the Marvel Cinematic Universe are method.
Yeah.
And everyone in the DC universe isn't. The only reason anyone got behind the Joker in Suicide Squad was because how method he was.
Yeah.
And then we see what happens.
I can make my own suit, right? Sure, why not?
Yep.
Oh, method actors. You're weird.
What's your favourite experience with an arthouse film?
I think it's the part when everyone started nodding and I was like, yeah, sure, boys. Have fun with that one. How long has this got to go? Oh, we're about an hour and a half. Super.
We're 4 hours in already.
I think I slept through half of it. It was brilliant.
and the majority of it's just been a guy in shades doing press-ups and looking into the camera.
Like, you would not believe how long a monologue can go. When you're at the 20-minute mark, and you think you're near the end, I'm afraid you're going to have to sit down, boy. Some more.
Well done for getting it all in one take, but Jesus Christ.
Oh, they did not. They did not get it all in one take.
I sort of came up with my own alternate universe concept where it just happens to... where days and nights just happen to last all of, 2 minutes or 5 minutes.
Yeah, but nothing to do with them just wanting to do a time-lapse for no reason.
And anyone who asks, why don't you shoot a scene that doesn't have a fucking window in it, is considered... apparently that's considered not particularly polite.
Little gauche, yeah.
But aside from... I could make fun, but I do enjoy that sort of thing when it's done professionally. Something like, I think one of my favourite films of all time is probably Drive.
Mm. I was going to say, like, there are some pretty good art movies out there. Like, I recently watched Mother not too long ago.
Mother was good, yeah.
Yeah, it's a film that's very up its own arse, but also I really, really
like. Are you sure? I thought it was quite subtle for me. I think the bit...
You can say a lot of things about the movie Mother. Subtle is not one of them.
You could say a lot of things. Ed Harris is in it. That's a thing. I liked it.
Spoiler alert with Mother.
Yeah, don't go thinking it's a Jennifer Lawrence horror film. No, don't. No.
Yeah, it's not a Jennifer Lawrence horror film.
I enjoyed that Red Sparrow film. Let's go watch this other film she was in recently. Oh God, no. Why didn't we show the kids?
Why?
God is dead, and Javier Bardem killed him. Oops.
I watched that. That with my parents the other day, and they had they had to go to sleep halfway through. Thank God.
They had like the idea that Mother made them go to sleep.
Yeah.
So it's like this is all too much, Tom. I'm going to have to sleep now.
So my brother, I think about a minute after they left, my brother realised what was going on. because it like the first half of that movie, you have no idea what it's about. You just know that Jennifer Lawrence is living in a house with Javier Bardem and Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer are there for some reason. They don't have names. They're just people.
Yeah,
they're credited as man and woman.
But then when the two like sons come in and I was like, oh, so it's about that. Okay.
Yeah. I love how we're trying not to spoil it. A film that got wide release for some reason.
I work at a cinema. It was the best. It was absolutely so brilliant. People were shouting at me. People. This one woman spent a good 5 minutes shouting at me. And it was the hardest experience in the world trying not to laugh. Like,
because I went to see it, I was like, this film's going to be weird. And then I had no idea how weird it would get.
It's Darren Aronofsky, it was going to get weird.
Yeah, but like, Black Swan has a sort of narrative that you can follow.
Mother, I see that.
Mother, if you lean into what you realise it's doing about halfway through, you're like, oh shit, yeah. But if you go in expecting a horror film and end up with this Bible allegory, then you're going to have a bad time.
You know what my favourite art film is?
Mm.
Colossal.
What? I wish I saw that one.
Would you call that an art film?
Yeah, if you imagine that none of the kaiju thing actually happens. It's all a metaphor.
Another one.
Well, it is really, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, it is all metaphor. But what I mean is, if it doesn't actually happen and it's entirely within her head, then you've got some seriously fucked up shit going on.
You know what else I'd call an art film that I was watching last night, and I've been watching like on and off on Netflix because Netflix is good like that. You can just
filter it in and out. Yeah.
Yeah. The Breakfast Club.
I've never seen it.
I've heard bits of the soundtrack.
It's weird. It's not what you'd think it would be. Because it is just like, it's five teenagers talking in a library for an hour and a half.
Mm.
That's it. And they all realise that they're not so different, even though they're all part of different cliques and stuff. And yeah, it's not, because it's directed by John Hughes, director of Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Home Alone, and it's not, I mean, it's got funny bits in it, but it's not a comedy. It's a serious drama.
I have heard it described as a film in which a load of teenagers discover the diversity of white people.
Yeah,
I like that. Yeah, I think the best art house sort of film I've seen recently is Nocturnal Animals.
Oh, right.
I'd honestly say it counts, and that it's probably the best response. You know those really trashy, pulpy rape revenge stories?
Oh, yeah.
It's a good response to that sort of thing.
Interesting. Would you call something like would you call Del Toro's work, much of it, arty? Because it's like, for instance, Pan's Labyrinth, I would call an art film, because nothing in it, huge parts of it could be kind of told through an unjustified, unreliable narrator.
I'd say it depends on who you talk to, and that's going to be the case with a lot of those sort of art housey sort of films. Some people might say Nicholas Winding Refn doesn't count because he had a film released in the cinema once, and that's too good for us. Someone with like Del Toro, who does experiment a lot with probably more cult iconography. Like, his focus is usually on monsters and how humans are the real monsters. And not the literal monsters.
That's all of his films.
Yeah.
Well,
they are films about
apart from Pacific Rim, in which the monsters are the monsters.
I get the feeling, though, that Pacific Rim Uprising is definitely back to form, even though Del Toro's not doing it. I get the feeling that Pacific Rim Uprising is the humans are the real monsters again.
But Pacific like Rim Uprising looks so bad.
But even it something
looks
like Crimson
Peak. I love it. I want to watch the shit out of it.
It looks.
I'm going to watch it in 3D with a giant bucket of popcorn and a baby screaming next to me. I'm going
to make sure that baby's there.
You're going to bring the baby.
See, I'm in the art house experience now. Like, I am. This is me looking down on my own profession. I'm enjoying this.
So, what makes an art house movie? Do we think? Like,
see, that's the problem. I'm going to come at this from the most, like, I've seen something like The Room should have been that sort of relegated to that sort of art house sphere of a failed project that is at the very least trying to go for a serious drama, but managed to become a cult icon through Tommy Wiseau's cult of personality, but that sort of thing. The Room is Baby Town Frolics, mates. Like, it gets worse. As much as I've seen. Yeah, as in, at the very least, it has something to hang on to. For the most part, they're with art housey sort of films. Either you go for really good foreign dramas or extremely low budget projects.
Yeah.
It's tough to say, isn't it? Because, like, you can say, I mean, you could easily make the case that all film is art, right? Calling something an art film is redundant. But, like, I think the things that what makes us tick over, right? What makes us go, okay, this has gone from being a film to an art film, and I would say it's like difficult, like how difficult it is to access the metaphor.
It's the opposite. Sometimes it's how fucking blunt can you be about it and still pretend to be clever, mate. I'm going to be the most cynical possible thing.
Well, I think an art film is something that tries to get a reaction from you that isn't just entertainment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Horror films entertain you in a scary way, but like art films, I think, would try to get you disgusted and like elated.
Something like a Eraserhead. Even though it's not a horror film, but it is supposed to make you
disgusting.
A lot of David Lynch's work.
Or maybe something I watched recently, The Florida Project. The aim of that one is to showcase probably a demographic that you wouldn't have heard of before. It's all about educating you while also displaying a story to you. It's definitely a drama. Although there are little funny bits in it, it's not trying to be... it's not supposed to be something you can easily describe, but by the end of it, you're supposed to be thinking, oh gosh, this is the sort of thing that actually happens in real life. This is something I may have taken for granted. I feel like something like that sort of film is a very good example of an art house film done properly.
Maybe an expression of something that hasn't been done in film before for the sake of it not being having been done in film before. You know.
Yes.
Trying to evoke something out of film that hasn't been attempted in that exact way before.
This should be an interesting episode of the Lines of Pitch podcast.
Well, if we struggle, you could always say that it is a major Hollywood star's pet project that was always going to be stupid, but at the very least they've got money to make it.
Birdman.
Yeah.
Birdman.
But, go back to the whole, disgusting thing and stuff like that. I think, like, an art film should always have people walking out of the cinema at some point during its release.
Either because like, this is too obvious.
Yeah,
or
it's too obvious, or it's too weird. This wasn't what I was expecting.
Or it's
like,
not
people
for
walked
me.
Out of Mother.
In two ways.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
If you say it's not for me, that works in two ways. Because first, it could be like this is beyond my standards of film. But secondly, or beyond my taste of film. But secondly, it could totally be this wasn't made for me. Like it was made for the artist.
Yeah. Like this wasn't for me is a good way of looking at it, I think, because it's like if it's like because film as a business is made for audiences.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's interesting then looking at how something like Mother was promoted as a horror film, first and foremost.
Oh, it was, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. With Jennifer Lawrence's name in big neon letters all the way through it.
Yeah.
But so are a lot of... Yeah, I guess... I think a lot of art films key off the horror genre. Because if you imagine, like, some of my favourite art films or shorts especially that he's not made any features yet are David Firth animations and they are tremendously arty, tremendously expressionate like pieces that just like David Lynch try to evoke a very specific visceral reaction from you and like they he does that in a number of ways. Like it's never exactly the same way, but it always comes back to the same thing of like, this wasn't there to entertain me. This was here to try to evoke something else. And that's what keeps me coming back is that every single time I watch a David Firth animation, I experience something new.
Yeah, I can see that. And sticking to animation, I also watched Loving Vincent recently, where that's all.
Oh, yeah.
Now, even though that's not so much about expressing a new type of story, I thought the story was kind of boilerplate, regular. It's just a conspiracy story about the death of Van Gogh.
It's a film noir, isn't it, at the end of the day?
Sort of. It's more about a... Yeah. I could imagine it being taught in schools.
Oh.
More to do with the life and times of Van Gogh during his years of being an artist struggling in France.
But is it... I don't know. I know you're not, like, an art historian, Adam, but, like, is it...
No.
Does it take liberties?
Occasional. Like, it's more to do with... displaying it's more about Van Gogh more than anything. It's not trying to be an accurate description of the real life events because too much of it was unknown at the time. I think the main point of it is to sort of offer an introduction to Van Gogh and his work.
If you put it on a scale between I don't know, something very, very accurate, what's a really accurate historical sort of take.
Ooh.
Dunkirk, right?
Oh yeah.
If you're on a scale between Dunkirk, Shakespeare in Love, and A Knight's Tale, where does it sit?
A Knight's Tale's based on the Chaucer poem. Yeah. That's not
it
real.
It absolutely is.
But yeah, Chaucer's in it.
Oh, no, no. It's not based on the Chaucer poem. It's based on what Chaucer wrote the poem about.
Yeah. It's Chaucer is in it, Tom.
But I'd say it's Loving Vincent is more... I'd say it's definitely more than Shakespeare in Love, but it's more about recounting stories that are already widely known in that circle, but just introducing it to people who otherwise wouldn't think to look into the life. They probably know his paintings through cultural osmosis.
Okay.
But the main point of the film is to bring to life those paintings through the animation work, which is absolutely astounding and worth the price of admission, happens.
It's incredible. Like, I think as art films go, that's the definition of art film, right?
It's art.
It is.
I'm not sure.
Such
that might
a beautiful
be cheating, Tom,
film.
To be honest.
It's a film about art, and the film is just art, frame by frame.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of other art films I've seen recently. I mean, Drive, you'd call an art film.
Definitely one of the more successful ones, yeah.
It's a weird one. Because I definitely call Drive... I think Drive is on that precipice of being just a general... just a crime movie.
But are we going for, a perception more than a genre,
Yeah.
Because
I'm looking at the Neon Demon... And what's it? Only God Forgives for other Nicholas Winning Refn movies.
That's when they are incredibly basic films when you actually look at them. But because of the style of a director and his use of lighting, imagery, and sometimes the script, I think that's why a lot of people are turned off by his work or attracted to it.
Yeah, I think he's the new Tarantino in a way, because he's a hero for art for film students. As in, when film students go to make a film, that I think he should be the person that they should look at now instead of, because I remember doing film making and stuff like that and being like, oh, this is the way Tarantino writes a movie. A load of quippy people and stuff like that. And I'm thinking now, people coming into making films with Nicholas Winding Refn in their...
this is how Nicholas Winding Refn writes a movie. He has Ryan Gosling stare at you for a good 5 minutes.
Yeah,
This is my analysis on why this is way better than everyone else. And I'm not even joking.
What did Nicholas Winding Refn do?
He did Drive, Neon Demon, Only God Forgives.
Valhalla Rising. I love that one.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff with Mads Mikkelsen.
Bronson.
Yeah.
I've seen that one, I think.
Yeah. And what was it? Yeah, because I was watching Drive the other day, and I was like, if Edgar Wright directed this, it would be Baby Driver.
Yeah.
Is Baby Driver an art film? That's the thing, that is also going for trying to subvert a lot of conventions of the genre. That's why I sort of think it's about a perception of films more than an actual genre.
I think it's maybe intent.
Like a Jim Jarmusch film.
I guess art film is in the eye of the beholder in terms of nobody sets out to make an art film. They set out to make a film that speaks to a certain demographic. If that certain demographic is people who are going to read far enough into it that they aren't going to walk out of the cinema when they're posed with a challenging film, then that's, I suppose, an art film, but it's also for general consumption by that demographic.
Yeah, it's a weird one. I think, you only get art films as such as artistic directors, I think, would be a... Because, when you mentioned Baby Driver being an art film, I was thinking, Edgar Wright's style is very... yeah, I think you're just sort of going into the role of authorship there.
Yeah, yeah.
More than anything. Yeah. I think with Nicholas winning Refn and Darren Aronofsky, definitely. I mean, these are like, sort of only... the only directors I can think of that are... David Lynch, I guess, as well, is very in the sort of tier of directors with art films that have been looked at by a lot of people, by a mass audience.
I'd also argue Paul Thomas Anderson with his most recent film was Phantom Thread.
Oh, was he the guy who did Boogie
Nights?
He did
There Will Be Blood, he did The Master, which I absolutely loved.
Who did Boogie Nights?
He did that, yeah.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Because, I would say him as well. I think authorship comes into what we're describing as art films, I think.
What would you say some of the key tropes for artistic films, or films that you would perceive as artistic? Because it's very easy, and I think possibly something we should do is to run down our assumptions of, like, that pretense of artistic intent, right? That sort of, this is how I imagined this, therefore it is justified in going into my film.
Yeah, I don't think there is a rule for art films.
Well, Adam, I don't think there is any trope. One where, like, well, there aren't that many shots without windows.
No, but the windows represent a mirror into your soul. So I would say one of the main, like, things is blunt metaphors.
Yeah, yeah. The window represents, like, how this character is viewing the world, and therefore the director.
That's the thing. God, how deep can you go down that sort of rabbit hole? Like, it's about how far you're willing to take the smallest of things. Like, if I can look outside and it's been snowing, what does the snow represent?
Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
No, but in the world of the art house, the cigar can mostly be everything.
Yeah,
the cigar is a symbol for hell, depending on how it's shot. Cigar, if it's shot a close-up of the flames, it could mean Satan and hell that is awaiting the character. Or it could just be, we're in Cuba. Put some Cuban music over it.
It's like weird because film is such a...
How you started that sentence and then realised you didn't know what Cuban music sounded like.
Here's a hint, Despacito.
Yeah, I know what Cuban music sounds like. I don't know what the genre is.
It doesn't sound a thing like that. That's Puerto Rico.
I don't know what Cuban music sounds like.
But yeah, I think the thing is, film is such a visual medium where everything on the screen has to be there for a reason. Let's say there's a shot of me sitting down, hunched over, and there's a table with a copy of the DVD Darkman in sight. I wouldn't put that there for no reason. Because it's a film, and the first thing you do is see something, you have to assume that if I've put the DVD of Darkman on full display, that has to mean something.
Everything is deliberate.
It kind of is. Like, there's this one film I watched called I Know Who Killed Me. It is Lindsay Lohan's best film ever. If you want to know how art house goes wrong, watch this
film.
How
dare you throw shade on Mean Girls?
I was going to say, Mean Girls is pretty good.
But I think it was Ebert who mentioned this sort of theory where if there's a scene where she tells her piano teacher that she's giving up piano lessons, there has to be a reason you've shown that.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a reason it's not in the DVD deleted scenes.
Chekhov's gun.
Stuff like that, yeah. As in, if that doesn't mean anything, then you've wasted the viewer's time and there's no reason for it, and everyone's going to think you're shit. But if that is there, for seemingly no reason. We have to remember it. So when it's revealed that the piano teacher is the main killer in the film, you're supposed to go, oh, it's because she didn't want to do the piano lessons anymore.
Yeah. Well, what was it? I was listening to Serious Disney's podcast, Dave Ballmer's fourth episode of Deconstruction of Frozen, and they were talking about what was it? It was something that just completely wasn't used. Oh yeah, the Olaf, the snowman, right? The symbol of childhood friendship of these. These two sisters, who, and also the symbol of the traumatic event, which was sealed away from Anna, so that she wouldn't fall prey to this magic, right?
That's the thing,
laid out, and then Olaf comes back. He says, "Oh, I'm Olaf, and I love warm hugs." Anna looks at Olaf and goes, oh, yeah, you do. And there's tinkly music, there's everything. Everything points to she's remembered a thing. And then nothing comes of it.
See, that's the thing. Like, a lot of people would look at a character like Olaf and think, no, it's just a stupid snowman that runs around. But there is ways to sort of interpret him as having a full-on purpose in a plot.
They always do. Like, it's well, not always, but I doubt you're going to find that sort of thing in the Emoji Movie, but, like...
The thing is, you can take Olaf out of Frozen and it'd be the same film.
But you can add one scene to Frozen and Olaf makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting... It's an interesting thing that like, some things got sewn into the plot... but never got their payoff.
That film was so destroyed in the editing process, though, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
That film went through about...
At least
20 different versions of it over a course of 70 years.
Yeah.
You've just reminded me, I think this was from a bit of the conversation earlier on, there is a filmmaking movement, I think, called Dogma 95.
Okay.
Which is weird. It's Lars von Trier.
Are you sure it's not Dogma 95?
Dogma 95.
Dogma 95.
Dogma 95. No, but like, this is very art house movie. Okay. There's just like rules for how a filmmaker is meant to make the film. I've got them up on Wikipedia here. Shooting must be done on location. Props and sets must not be brought in.
Okay.
If a particular prop is necessary for the story, a location must be chosen where this prop is to be found. The sound must never be produced apart from the images or vice versa. So, yeah, you have to record the sound on location as well.
Oh, yikes.
In the shot. No music as well, unless it's in the shot. The camera must be handheld. Any movement or immobility attainable in the hand is permitted. The film must be in colour. Special lighting is not acceptable.
This sounds rubbish.
Optical work and filters are forbidden.
For Bolton.
The film must not contain superficial action, murders, weapons, etc. Temporal and geographical alienation are forbidden. That is to say that the film takes place here and now. Genre movies are not acceptable. The film format must be Academy 35mm, and the director must not be credited. Wow!
But, wow!
As in, a lot of directors of that style will go for all these sort of rules to try and experiment with how we interpret film.
Yeah, I guess that's what that's there for.
That sounds to me like a game jam, you know, or a writing jam or whatever.
yeah,
you know, where essentially someone's gone, right, here's these rules. Let's make a fucking.
You've got
film.
To make a film in a day.
Yeah, let's see what happens.
That kind of thing. Yeah.
And see what you make with it.
little note on that, on this style. The use of Dogma 95 is used as a reference in the Black Mirror episode The National Anthem. It's to ensure that the National Anthem is the one where the Prime Minister has to foot the pig.
Yeah.
And the hostage taker says, "You've got to shoot the pig fucking Dogma 95 so I know it's not faked."
Right.
That's, yeah, that quite a lot of news broadcasts would be Dogma 95, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Sounds like boring films.
Vine videos.
Yeah.
Yeah. Vine videos are Dogma 95. Yeah. Well, no, they're not shot on Academy 35mm.
That's true.
That's, yeah.
We are really close to me saying the words, the memes are the new art house, and I think we should stop before I embarrass myself any further.
Memes are the new art house, that's true.
Okay, so from Ross _ originals, we've got Oh Well.
Ooh.
Oh well.
Oh well.
No. Oh well.
That has to be like a Woody Allen type neurotic comedy, where increasing
set at the bottom of a well.
That has to be the finale, though. As in, it's a film where increasingly confusing yet demoralising things keep happening to someone, but they keep going oh well at the end of it and just walk off.
What if every single time, he does something awkward, he like that we suddenly the screen goes black, we hear a heartbeat, and then stark neon demon style side lighting, we see him like in a vest and pants with a shovel digging into the ground, and then he opens his eyes and he's back in the situation, right? And then, like, as the film goes on, he starts doing more and more neurotic and awkward things.
But he keeps going back to the world.
Yeah, every single time something awkward happens, he just, like, closes his eyes and we see him close his eyes and then cut to black. There he is in this well world within his brain. Where essentially he's just digging this well.
With his brain?
Like
is his brain. Is his brain on a plinth next to him in the well?
In his brain.
Spotlighted.
Okay, I've already imagined this. This is what happens when Adam Sandler goes crazy doing one of his Netflix films. And it's just that sort of comedy.
I would like to see Adam Sandler digging a hole in his vest and pants.
And then at the end he just... But then he goes back to the real world and just says... Oh well, and it just carries on.
Well, I think definitely, like we keep doing this, we keep cutting back to this thing, and then eventually, like he sort of thinks he's got his shit together. Like he starts taking classes on how not to be like a terrible human being. Like beforehand, he's like making passes at women, really like overtly and being a dick about it, right? And
is it Woody Allen or
Adam Sandler?
I just said it was Woody Allen.
Adam Sandler.
So he's making overt, like really, like gross passes at women all the time, and every time he does it, like, and they reject him. He has this thing where he flashes into this thing, digs a single scoop of dirt, opens his eyes again, and they've left, or he runs away or whatever. Then he starts taking classes, starts becoming a better person. Thinks he's becoming more socially adept, and eventually, like, he's got...
Hang on, I want to see the classes that make you be a better person.
Philosophy and neuro-linguistic programming.
He's probably going to go to a self-help guru on better dating and pickup lines.
Yep. That's it. And
he takes classes with a guy called Roosh V.
Yeah.
If you've not heard of him, Google it.
Don't Google him. He's a dick. Anyway, that fits the metaphor better, because then he thinks he's got his shit together, because he's like got a date, like he's slept with a woman. He's being more successful, quote unquote, and then he brings someone home and then just falls through the floor of his house into the bottom of this well that he's literally been digging.
He's been digging a well.
He just didn't realise it.
His own inadequacies and shortcomings.
But has he though?
Oh yeah. We see the shot.
Is he just trapped in his mind?
We see the shot of him waking up next to a woman that he's picked up at a bar, and then
played by Natalie Portman.
Yeah, and then he steps out, puts his legs over the side of the bed, stands up, and then the floor just goes, and he just falls into this well, where he's now trapped with a shovel and some water up to his knees.
No, he just keeps falling. It's like the opening titles for Mad Men. He's just falling, falling, falling. The song from the opening titles of Mad Men comes on. And then it just keeps playing for another 2 hours.
For a second,
as
Tom,
he falls.
I thought you were doing the theme to Blind Date, which you were now, and therefore it's not the opening titles of Mad Men. It's
Oh my god, is the opening titles for Mad Men just the Blind Date soundtrack but slowed down?
It's Blind Date.
It has to be like slowed down times 500 so that people think it's the Mad Men theme, but we can't afford it.
So it's just.
We have to make this on a budget, people. Like, this isn't the blockbuster studio produced shit.
No, this is Hans Zimmer doing the Blind Date theme tune.
Can I pay him just to do that?
I really want to now. Now I've suggested it, I'm like, why won't he do it? Why isn't he listening to this, and why isn't he doing it right now? Okay, so that was Oh Well.
Again,
Oh Well
experience.
Adam Sandler will never be the same again.
I believe Netflix described it as, how desperate do you think we are?
speaking of going to the toilet, I just drank a pint of water. Now I need one.
Welcome. I need to find out why my brother came in the door, so I just need to go have a check. I'll be back in a bit.
Old Tommy boy's on his own again. I'm so lonely. Everyone has gone to the toilet. I'm gonna put it on and boil it. Boop, boop, doop, boop, boom, boom, boom. Tommy boy is alone again. So how are you enjoying the podcast so far? Let us know. Go to facebook.com/ Life's a Pitch podcast and Twitter as well @ Life's a Pitch show. Let us know what you enjoyed about the episode. Let us know what you didn't enjoy about the episode. It'll be great if you could let us know on those social media things. Oh, you're back. Cool. Hello, just want to say thank you for listening to the Life's a Pitch deleted scenes.
We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have, maybe consider sharing it with your friends on social media, by word of mouth, anywhere really. Maybe put it onto a thumb drive and just throw it at someone. And maybe even reviewing it on wherever you got it. If you find it somewhere on iTunes or Acast or wherever, maybe review it there. 5 stars, thumbs up, give everyone the heads up.
Like I said before, thank you. Cheers.
Right.
Bye.